What if you received a phone call telling you that today, this ordinary Tuesday or unremarkable Saturday, would be your last day alive? Adam Silvera's They Both Die at the End doesn't ease you into this question. It throws you into the deep end, just as it does with Mateo and Rufus, two teenage boys who receive the dreaded death cast notification in the early hours of September 5th, 2017. Since its 2017 release, this young adult novel has become a cultural phenomenon, surging to #1 on the New York Times bestseller list 3 years after publication through BookTok's viral embrace. Celebrities like Lil Nas X have championed its raw emotional power, and Netflix is adapting it for the screen. But beyond the commercial success lies something more profound, a story that forces us to confront how we'd live if we knew exactly when we'd die. The title spoils the ending, yet millions of readers have found themselves unable to put it down, desperate to witness how these two strangers spend their final hours. In Silvera's world, everything mirrors our reality except for one chilling difference. Deathcast exists. This mysterious service calls people between midnight and 3 a.m. to inform them they'll die within 24 hours. No explanations about how or when, just the certainty that this is their end day. Mateo Torres gets his call at 12:22 a.m. The 18-year-old Puerto Rican boy sits alone in his apartment, his father lying comatose in a hospital. Mateo has spent his life hiding, taking online courses, playing piano for an audience of none, rarely venturing beyond his walls. He realizes with crushing clarity that he's never truly lived. Across the city, at 1:05 a.m., Rufus Emeritario receives his deathcast call mid-punch. The 17-year-old Cuban-American foster kid lost his entire family 4 months earlier when their car plunged into the Hudson River. When police arrive to arrest him for assault, he flees. He can't waste his final hours in jail. Both boys face the same terrifying question. How do you make your last day meaningful? Desperate not to die alone, they download the Last Friend app, a service connecting deckers with companions for their end day. Mateo's Last Friend search exposes humanity's uglier side. Users seeking hookups, drugs, or furniture movers, deepening his isolation until he finds Rufus, who downloads the app while hiding from police. Their video chat reveals stark contrasts. Mateo in his Luigi hat, radiating nervous kindness. Rufus with his buzzed head and survival-hardened eyes, projecting toughness over vulnerability. Yet, they recognize shared understanding, mortality, and interrupted youth. When Rufus promises to be the Mario to his Luigi, it's more than gaming banter. It's an unspoken covenant between two boys facing death. Mateo's decision to let this stranger into his sanctuary marks a profound shift, proving authentic bonds can form in unexpected places, burning brightest against mortality's backdrop. Mateo's transformation from fearful recluse to someone who embraces life forms the novel's most profound arc. He describes himself as a time bomb of anxiety, perpetually convinced any risk will lead to disaster. His first act of courage? Letting Rufus into his apartment. At the hospital, he sings Leonard Cohen's Take This Waltz at his father's bedside, revealing the beautiful voice he's kept hidden. When they encounter a homeless man, Mateo insists on helping, explaining that asking for help when you need it should be enough. Kindness isn't about karma, but recognizing humanity. His boldest move comes in the El Yunque rainforest room, jumping hand in hand with Rufus from a 20-foot waterfall cliff, symbolizing his willingness to finally plunge into life. While Mateo battles having lived too cautiously, Rufus wrestles with survivor's guilt. 4 months earlier, his parents and sister Olivia drowned after their car crashed into the Hudson River. Though they helped him escape, he couldn't save them. His guilt manifests in self-destructive behavior, beating up his ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend, carrying his sister's childhood blanket everywhere, posting only black and white Instagram photos as if color died with his family. His healing begins when he meets Mateo, whose gentleness creates space for processing grief. At Chelsea Pier, Mateo takes Rufus to face the water, where he finally breaks down, confessing his anger at his family for giving up after helping him escape. Mateo's growth peaks at Clint's graveyard, where he performs American Pie on stage with Rufus. The shy boy who once hid from the world now sings before a crowd, initiates his first kiss with Rufus, and punches Peck despite his lifelong fear. By day's end, Mateo tells Rufus, "You didn't just keep me alive, you made me live." His transformation isn't about becoming someone else, it's about becoming fully himself, brave enough to love and embrace whatever life remains. Rufus's pivotal moment comes at the World Travel Arena when Mateo encourages him to jump from the waterfall cliff despite his fear of water. Rufus describes it as a baptism, where he ditches anger, sadness, and blame beneath the surface. This symbolic rebirth allows him to forgive himself for surviving. He unloads Peck's gun rather than perpetuating violence, gives away his beloved bike, and tells Mateo, "I love you," embracing the vulnerability he once feared. Through Mateo's friendship, Rufus learns that surviving means honoring those you've lost by fully embracing life. They Both Die at the End portrays family as something created through choice, not blood. Both protagonists have lost their biological families. Mateo's mother died in childbirth and his father lies comatose. Rufus's entire family drowned. Yet they build meaningful connections that form a different kind of family. Rufus found belonging at Pluto Home with Malcolm, Togo, and Amy, outcasts who became family through loyalty. Mateo's chosen family consists of Lydia and her baby daughter Penny, for whom he serves as godfather. When Mateo and Rufus meet through Last Friend, they quickly form their own intimate family unit. Despite knowing each other less than a day, they develop a profound connection. As Rufus observes, "We may have been strangers this morning, but we're proper friends now." The novel's most powerful statement about found family comes when these worlds collide at Clint's graveyard. The Plutos meet Lydia and Mateo, creating a unified family bound by love. The novel confronts a cruel truth. Mateo and Rufus experience more authentic living in their final 24 hours than in all their previous years combined. This paradox, that we often only truly appreciate life when faced with its end, forms the story's philosophical heart. Deathcast embodies a profound contradiction, causing immense suffering by robbing people of hope, yet granting the gift of certainty and preparation. Time transforms for Deckers. Minutes stretch and compress. Insignificant moments become precious. Arbitrary distinctions between strangers and friends collapse. Mateo and Rufus's relationship develops at an accelerated pace that would seem implausible under normal circumstances, yet their impending deaths create unique freedom. Mateo's final declaration captures everything. Two dudes met, they fell in love, they lived. Three simple sentences that many who live decades longer never achieve. This story isn't about dying, it's about the courage to be vulnerable, to love despite inevitable loss, to be fully seen. It's about recognizing that chosen families can be as meaningful as biological ones, and that existing and living are fundamentally different things. We live in a world obsessed with longevity, biohacking, supplements, exercise regimens promising extra years. But Mateo and Rufus teach something more essential. Duration matters less than depth. They had hours, not decades, yet loved more authentically, and many do in a lifetime. Here's the question Silvera leaves us with. Why do we wait for Deathcast to call before we start truly living? Your end day is coming. Will you spend it hiding in fear or embracing the messy, terrifying, beautiful experience of being fully alive?